The rain will wash much off, but tests made years ago show that some of these poisons, those on the undersides of fences, for example, will persist for weeks, even months. We would need thousands of decontamination teams even to begin the task of making our country safe enough for our citizens to walk to their markets. Colonel Melitin is correct. If the Russians use their gas weapons, and then the Americans reply in kind, we would be fortunate if half our citizens were alive 6 months from today. It is actually easier to protect our citizens from nuclear weapons than against gases, and nuclear effects are shorter-lived.
Du lieber Gott.
Moscow, RSFSR.
They said what?
The defense minister almost screamed. Our fraternal socialist comrades of the German Democratic Republic have informed us that they can only view the use of chemical munitions inside their territory as a matter of the gravest national concern. The foreign minister spoke dryly. Moreover, they have forwarded to us intelligence reports which show clearly that the use of such weapons would only serve to harden NATO resolve and possibly open the door to other weapons of mass destruction.
But they are part of the plan, defense objected.
Comrades, Sergeyev observed, we all know that the use of chemical munitions will have calamitous effects on civilians. Wouldn't this compromise our political maskirovka? Aren't we saying that our quarrel is with the West German government? How might it look, then, if on the first day of the war we coldly exterminate many thousands of civilians? How many more innocents shall we slaughter, he thought.
And there is another question, said Brumkovsky.
Old and frail though he was still an experienced man from the last war against the Germans, and his views on defense affairs still commanded respect.
If we use these weapons against all the NATO armies, and how can we restrict them to German formations? America and France have made it clear that they consider gas as a weapon of mass destruction, to which they would respond in kind.
The American chemical arsenal is a joke, replied Defense.
I have seen studies from your ministry that suggest otherwise,
Brumkovsky shot back.
And perhaps you will laugh at their nuclear weapons. If we kill many thousands of German civilians, their government will demand the use of atomic weapons against targets in our territory. If our gas weapons kill some thousands of American soldiers, do you think the American president will refrain from using his own weapons of mass destruction? Comrades, we have discussed this before. This war against NATO is a political operation, no? Do we cast away our political camouflage by using a weapon like this? We have the assurance now that at least one NATO country will not join in a Russian-German war. This is a great victory for our political policy. The use of chemical weapons will cast away that advantage and open political dangers from more than one direction. I feel that we should retain control of these weapons in the Politburo.
Comrade Defense Minister, are you telling us that we can win only if weapons of mass destruction are used? The old man leaned forward and spoke with harsh determination.
Has the situation changed? You will remember telling us that if strategic surprise were lost, our armies could be recalled. Has surprise been lost?
The Defense Minister's face went rigid for a moment. The Soviet army is ready and able to carry out its mission. It is now too late to retreat. This is also a political question, Petya. NATO is mobilizing, Sergeyev said.
Too late and too half-heartedly, replied the director of the KGB. We have split one country from the NATO alliance. We are working on others, and are hard at work throughout Europe and America spreading disinformation about the bomb attack. The will of the people in the NATO countries is low. They will not want to fight a war for German murderers, and their political leaders will find a way to disassociate themselves from the conflict.
But not if we slaughter civilians with gas. The foreign minister nodded. Petya and young Sergeyev are correct. The political cost of these weapons is simply too high. Washington, D.C. But why? Why are they doing this? The president demanded. We simply do not know, sir. The director of Central Intelligence was clearly uncomfortable with the question. We know that this Kremlin bomb plot was a complete fabrication. Did you see what the Post said this morning? The press says that this guy Falcon has agency, or its German equivalent, written all over him. Mr. President, the truth of the matter is that Herr Falcon was almost certainly a Soviet sleeper agent under KGB control. The Germans have been unable to uncover very much about him. It's as though he just sprang into being 13 years ago, and he's been quietly running his import-export business for the last 12 years. Sir, every indication we have is that the Soviets are prepared for an attack against NATO. There is no indication, for example, that they are demobilizing their conscripts who are at the end of their enlistment periods, nor any evidence of preparations for the new class of conscripts that should have begun to arrive several days ago. Finally, there's the case of this Spetsnaz major the Germans picked up. He was infiltrated into the Federal Republic before the bomb plot, with orders to attack a NATO communications base. As to why, Mr. President, we simply do not know. We can describe what the Russians are doing, but not the reason for it. I told the country last night that we would be able to control this situation through diplomatic means. We still might. We need to communicate directly with the Soviets, the president's national security adviser said. Until they respond positively, however, we have to show that we mean business, too. Mr. President, a further call-up of reservists is necessary. North Atlantic. The Julius Fusik was rolling 10 degrees with a beam sea. It made life hard on the soldiers, Captain Kirov noted, but they were doing well for landsmen. His own crewmen were dangling over the sides with spray guns, painting over the ship's interlighter markings, preparatory to replacing them with the Likes Lines emblem. The soldiers were cutting away parts of the superstructure to conform with the silhouette of the Dr. Likes, a U.S. flag CB carrier remarkably similar to the Fusik. The Soviet ship had been built years before in Finland's Valmet yard from plans purchased in America. Already the elevator winch area aft had been painted completely black to match the American line's house colors, and a black diamond had been painted on both sides of the superstructure. Gangs of men were changing the shape and colors of the two funnels with prefabricated parts. The hardest job remaining was the paintwork on the hull. The interlighter markings were made of 20-foot letters. Replacing them called for the use of canvas templates, and the lettering had to be neat and exact. Worst of all, there was no way to check the workmanship short of launching a ship's boat, something he had neither the time nor the inclination to do.
How long, comrade captain?
4 hours at least. The work goes well.
Kirov couldn't hide his concern. Here they were, mid-Atlantic, far from the usual sea lanes. But there was no telling.
And if we are spotted by an American aircraft or ship? General Andreev asked.
Then we will find out how effective our damage control drills have been, and our mission will be a failure.
Kirov ran his hand along the polished teak rail. He'd commanded this ship for 6 years, taken her into nearly every port on the North and South Atlantic.
We'll get some way on. The ship will ride more easily on a bow sea.
Moscow, RSFSR.
When are you planning to leave? Flynn asked Calloway.
Soon, Patrick. I hope you'll be coming with me.
The unmarried children of both men were in college, and both had sent their wives west the day before.
I don't know. I've never run away before. Flynn scowled at the empty stage at the end of the room. He had the scars to prove it.
They pay me to report the news.
You'll be reporting no bloody news from inside Lefortovo prison, my friend, Calloway observed. Isn't one Pulitzer Prize enough?
Flynn laughed. I thought nobody but me remembered.
What do you know that I don't, Willie?
I know I wouldn't be leaving without a damned good reason. And if it's good enough for me to leave, Patrick, it's bloody good enough for you.
He'd been told only the night before that a peaceful resolution of this crisis was now less than a 50% probability. For the 100th time, the Reuters correspondent blessed his decision to cooperate with the SIS.
Here we go. Flynn took out his notepad.
The foreign minister entered from the usual door and moved to the lectern. He looked uncharacteristically frazzled, his suit rumpled, his shirt collar dingy, as though he'd been up all the previous night laboring to resolve the German crisis through diplomatic means. When he looked up, his eyes squinted through his reading glasses.
"Ladies and gentlemen, a year that has gone so well for East-West relations has turned to ashes in the mouths of us all. The United States, the Soviet Union, and the other nations that accepted our invitation to Vienna are within weeks of a comprehensive agreement on the control of strategic nuclear arms. America and the Soviet Union have agreed upon and implemented a grain sales agreement with unprecedented speed and cooperation. And even as we speak, deliveries are being made in Odessa on the Black Sea. Western tourism within the Soviet Union is at an all-time high, and this is perhaps the truest reflection of the spirit of détente. Now our peoples are finally beginning to trust one another. All this effort, the efforts of East and West to bring about a just and lasting peace, have been brought to ruin by a handful of revanchist men who have not taken the lessons of the Second World War to heart.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Soviet Union has received irrefutable evidence that the government of the Federal Republic of Germany exploded its bomb in the Kremlin as part of a plot to bring about the reunification of Germany by force. We have in our possession classified German documents which prove that the West German government planned to bring down the Soviet government and use the resulting period of internal confusion to achieve their aim of remaking Germany into the principal continental power in Europe yet again. All Europeans know what that would mean to world peace. In this century, Germany has invaded my country twice. Over 40 million Soviet citizens died repelling those two invasions. And we do not forget the deaths of so many millions of our fellow Europeans who were also the victims of German nationalism. Polish, Belgian, Dutch, French, English, and American men and women labored as our allies to safeguard the peace of Europe. After the Second World War, we all thought that this problem was completely at an end. Such was the reasoning behind the treaties which divided Germany and Europe into spheres of influence. Remember that these spheres were ratified further by the Helsinki Accords in 1975, whose balance would serve to make a European war impossible. We know that the rearming of Germany by the West, supposedly a defensive measure against the imagined threat from the East, despite the fact that the Warsaw Pact was not even formed until well after the NATO alliance was formed, was the first step in the West's own plan to unify Germany as a pawn to counterbalance the Soviet Union. That this was a foolish and unnecessary policy is now manifestly clear. I ask you if there is anyone in Europe who truly wants a unified Germany. The NATO countries themselves stopped agitating for this years ago. Except, of course, for some Germans who remember the days of German power in rather a different light from those of us who were its victims. The Federal Republic of Germany has evidently turned the tables on her Western allies,
and plans to use the NATO alliance as a shield behind which to launch her own offensive operations, the objective of which can only upset the power balance that has safeguarded the peace in Europe for two generations. Although we can fault the West for creating this situation, the government of the Soviet Union does not, I repeat, does not, hold America or her NATO allies responsible for this. My country, too, has learned the bitter lesson that allies can turn on their supposed friends, much as a dog can turn on his master. The Soviet Union has no wish to cast away the dramatic progress made this year in foreign relations with the West. The foreign minister paused before going on. But the Soviet Union cannot ignore, cannot set aside the fact that a deliberate act of aggression has been made against the Soviet Union, on Soviet soil. The government of the Soviet Union will today deliver a note to the Bonn government. As a price of our forbearance, as a price of keeping the peace, we demand that the Bonn government immediately demobilize its army to a level consistent with maintenance of the civil peace. We further call upon the Bonn government to admit its aggressive action, to dissolve and call for new elections, so that the German people themselves may judge how well they have been served. Finally, we demand and expect that full reparations be paid to the government of the Soviet Union and to the families of those so callously murdered by the revanchist German nationalists who hide in their city on the west bank of the Rhine. Failure to meet with these demands will have the gravest possible consequences. As I have already said, we have no reason whatever to believe that any other Western nation had the slightest complicity in this act of international terrorism. This crisis is, therefore, a matter between the government of the Soviet Union and the government in Bonn. It is our hope that this crisis can be resolved through diplomatic means. We call on the Bonn government to consider the consequences of its actions with the greatest care, and to act to preserve the peace. That is all I have to say. The foreign minister gathered his papers and left. The gathered reporters did not even attempt to shout questions at the receding form. Flynn tucked his notepad back into his pocket and screwed his pen closed. The AP correspondent had stayed behind at Phnom Penh to see the arrival of the Khmer Rouge, almost at the cost of his life. He'd covered wars, revolutions, riots, and been wounded twice as a result of his devotion to his business. But covering wars was a young man's game. When are you planning to leave?
Wednesday at the latest. I already have two tickets reserved, SAS to Stockholm, Calloway answered.
I'm going to cable New York to shut down the Moscow office tomorrow. I'll stick around until you leave, but really it's time to go. If I cover any more of this story, it'll be from a safer place.
How many wars have you covered, Patrick?
Korea was my first. Haven't missed many since then. Damn near bled to death at a place called Kanchien. Caught two mortar fragments in the Sinai in 73.
USS Faris. DEFCON 2. Rules of Engagement Option Bravo now in effect. This message is to be understood as a war warning, Morris read in the privacy of his stateroom. Hostilities between NATO and the Warsaw Pact are now to be considered as likely, but not certain. Take all measures consistent with the safety of your command. Hostilities could initiate without repeat without warning. Ed Morris lifted his phone.
Call the XO to my stateroom.
He was there in under a minute.
I hear you got a hot message, Skipper.
DEFCON 2, row option Bravo.
He handed over the terse message form.
We start maintaining round-the-clock condition 3 steaming at once. The ASROC and torpedo tube directors are to be manned at all times.
What do we tell the men?
I want to go over this with the wardroom first. Then I'll speak to the crew. We haven't got specific operations orders yet. I figure we head either to Norfolk or New York for convoy duty.
USS Nimitz.
Okay, Toland, let's hear it.
Baker sat back in his chair.
Admiral, NATO has increased its alert level. The President has authorized DEFCON 2. The Naval Defense Reserve Fleet is being mobilized. Reforger will begin at 0100 Zulu. The commercial jets are already being taken into military service. The Brits have enacted Queen's Order 2. A lot of airports in Germany are going to be busy as hell.
How long to complete, Reforger?
8 to 12 days, sir.
We may not have that long.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about their satellite reconnaissance, Baker ordered.
Admiral, they currently have one radar ocean reconnaissance satellite up, Cosmos 1801. It's paired with Cosmos 1813, an electronic intelligence bird. 1801 is the nuclear-powered radar bird, and we think it may have a photographic capability to back up the radar system.
I've never heard that before.
NSA detected indications of a video signal several months ago, but that information was never released to the Navy because it was unconfirmed.
Toland didn't say that it had been decided at the time the Navy didn't need to know this.
They needed to know now, Toland judged.
I'm here now.
I'd expect that Ivan has another of his radar satellites ready for immediate launch, probably a few more in the barn. They've been launching an unusual number of their low-altitude communications birds, plus a lot of electronic intelligence satellites. Ordinarily, they have 6 or 7 of them up, but now the total is 10. That gives them awfully good ELINT coverage. If we make electronic noise, they'll hear it.
And not a goddamn thing we can do about them.
Not for a while, sir, Toland agreed. The Air Force has its anti-satellite missiles, 6 or 7 as I recall, but they've only been tested once against a real satellite. And there's been a moratorium on the ASAT tests since last year. The Air Force can probably dust them off and try to reactivate the program, but that'll take a few weeks. Their first priority is the radar satellites, Toland concluded, hopefully.
Okay, our orders are to rendezvous with Saratoga at the Azores and escort our Marine Amphibious Unit to Iceland. I suppose the Russians will watch us all the way up. Hopefully, by the time we get there, the Icelandic government will allow us to land them. I just learned that their government can't decide if this crisis is real or not. God, I wonder if NATO will hold together.
Supposedly, we have proof that it's all a put-up job, but we don't need to know what that evidence is. The problem is that a lot of countries are buying the charade, at least publicly.
Yeah, I love that. I want you to refine your estimate of the threat from Soviet subs and aircraft on a continuous basis. I want information about the smallest change in what they have at sea the moment you get it.
Chapter 15. The Bastion Gambit. USS Chicago.
What's the sounding? McCafferty asked quietly.
50 feet under the keel. The navigator answered at once. We're still well outside Russian territorial waters, but we start approaching real shoals in 20 miles, Skipper.
It was the 8th time in half an hour that he had commented on what lay ahead.
McCafferty nodded, not wanting to speak, not wanting to make any unnecessary sound at all. The tension hung in the attack center of the Chicago like the cigarette smoke that the ventilators would not entirely remove. Looking around, he caught his crewmen furtively disclosing their states of mind with a raised eyebrow or a slightly shaken head. The navigator was the most nervous of all. There were all sorts of good reasons not to be here. Chicago might or might not have been in Soviet territorial water, itself a legal question of no small complexity. To the northeast was Cape Kanin. To the northwest, Cape Svyatoy. The Soviets claimed the entire region as an historic bay, while the United States chose to recognize the international 24-mile closure rule.
Everyone aboard knew that the Russians were more likely to shoot today than request a decision under the International Law of the Sea Convention. Would the Russians find them? They were in a bare 30 fathoms of water. And, like the great pelagic sharks, nuclear attack submarines are creatures of the deep, not the shallows. The tactical plot showed bearings to 3 Soviet patrol craft, 2 Grisha-class frigates, and a Poti-class corvette, all specialized anti-submarine ships. All were miles away, but they were still a very real threat. The only good news was a storm overhead. The 20-knot surface wind and sheets of falling rain made noise that interfered with sonar performance. But that included their own sonar, and sonar was their only safe means for getting information. Then there were the imponderables. What sensing devices did the Soviets have in these waters? Might the water be clear enough that a circling helicopter or ASW aircraft could see them? Might there be a Tango-class diesel boat out there, moving slowly on her quiet, battery-powered electric motors? The only way they'd learn the answer to any of those questions was the metallic whine of a torpedo's high-speed propellers, or the simple explosion of a falling depth bomb. McCafferty considered all these things, and weighed the dangers against the priority of his flash directive from Comsublant. Determine at once the operating areas of Red Fleet SSBNs. That sort of language gave him little leeway. How tight is the inertial fix? McCafferty asked as casually as he could. Plus or minus 200 yards. The navigator didn't even look up. The captain grunted, knowing what the navigator was thinking. They should have gotten a Navstar satellite fix a few hours ago, but the risk of detection was too high in an area crawling with Soviet surface craft. 200 yards, plus or minus, was fine accuracy by any rational standard. But not while submerged in shallow water off a hostile coast. How accurate were his charts? Were there unmarked wrecks out there? Even if his navigational data were completely accurate, quarters would be so tight in another few miles that a goof of 200 yards could ground them, damaging the submarine, and making noise. The captain shrugged to himself. The Chicago was the best platform in the world for this mission. He'd done this sort of thing before, and he couldn't worry about everything at the same time. McCafferty took a few steps forward and leaned into the sonar compartment. How's our friend doing? Continuing as before, Skipper. No changes at all in the target's radiated noise level. Just tooling right along at 15 knots, dead ahead, no more than 2,000 yards off. Pleasure cruise, like, the sonar chief concluded with no small irony. Pleasure cruise. The Soviets were sortieing their ballistic missile submarines at intervals of 1 sub every 4 hours. Already a majority of them were at sea. They had never done that before. And all seemed to be heading east, not north and northeast, as they usually did to cruise in the Barents or Kara Seas, or, most recently, under the Arctic ice cap itself. Sacklant had learned that piece of information from Norwegian P-3 aircraft patrolling Checkpoint Charlie, the spot 50 miles offshore where Soviet submarines always submerged. Chicago, the nearest sub to the area, had been sent to investigate. They'd soon detected and gotten into trail position behind a Delta III, a modern Soviet boomer, as missile subs were known. Trailing her, they'd stayed within the 100-fathom curve the whole way, until the target had turned southeast into shallow water toward Mis Syatoynos, which led to the entrance to the White Sea, all of which was Soviet territorial water. How far did they dare follow? And what was going on? McCafferty returned to control and went to the periscope pedestal. "Look around," he said. "Upscope."
A petty officer turned the hydraulic ring control, and the portside search periscope slid upward from its well.
Hold.
McCafferty stooped at the conning station, catching the instrument as the quartermaster stopped it below the surface. From a position that was murderously uncomfortable, the skipper duck-walked the scope in a full circle. On the forward bulkhead was a television monitor which worked off a camera built into the scope. It was watched by the executive officer and a senior petty officer.
"No shadows," McCafferty said. Nothing to make him suspect that something was there.
"Concur, skipper," the XO agreed.
"Check with sonar."
Forward, the sonar watch listened carefully. Circling aircraft made noise, and there was about an even chance that they'd heard it. But now they heard nothing, which didn't mean that nothing was there, like maybe a high-flying chopper or another Grisha laying to, her diesels shut down as she drifted, listening for someone like Chicago.
"Sonar says they don't have anything, skipper," the XO reported.
"Two more feet," McCafferty ordered. The quartermaster worked the lever again, bringing the periscope up by 23 inches, just barely out of the water in the troughs of the waves.
"Skipper!"
It was the senior ESM technician. The highest item on Chicago's periscope was a miniature antenna array which fed signals to a broadband receiver. The instant it projected above the surface, three lights flickered on the ESM tactical warning board. "I read 3, 5, maybe 6 India band search radars. Signature characteristics say ship and land-based search radar, sir. Not, repeat, not aircraft sets. Nothing in the Juliet band." The technician started reading off the bearings. McCafferty allowed himself to relax. There was no way a radar could detect so small a target as his periscope in these waves. He turned the periscope in a complete circle.
"I see no surface ships, no aircraft. Seas about 5 feet. Estimate the surface wind from the northwest at, about 20-25 knots.
He snapped up the handles and stepped back.
"Downscope."
The oiled steel tube was heading down before he'd spoken the second word. The captain nodded approval at his quartermaster, who held out a stopwatch. The scope had been up above the surface for a total of 5.9 seconds. After 15 years in submarines, it still amazed him how so many people could do so much in 6 seconds. When he'd gone through submarine school, the criterion had been a 7-second exposure. The navigator examined his chart quickly, a quartermaster assisting him to plot the bearings to the signal sources.
"Captain."
The navigator looked up. "Bearings are consistent with 2 known shore radar transmitters, and 3 Don 2 sets match the bearings of Sierra 2, 3, and 4. He referred to the plotted positions of the 3 Soviet surface ships. "We got one unknown bearing 047. What's that one look like, Harkins?"
"A land-based India band surface search, one of those new shore cans," the technician responded, reading off frequency and pulse width numbers.
"Weak signal and kind of fuzzy, sir. Lots of activity, though, and all the transmitters are dialed into different frequencies."
The technician meant that the radar searches were well coordinated, so that the radar transmitters would not interfere with one another. An electrician rewound the videotape, allowing McCafferty to re-examine what he'd seen through the periscope. The only difference was that the periscope TV camera was black and white. The tape had to be run at slow speed to avoid blurring, so rapidly had the captain made his visual search.
"Amazing how good nothing can look, eh, Joe?" he asked his executive officer.
The cloud ceiling was well below 1,000 feet, and the wave action had rapidly coated the periscope lens with water droplets. No one had ever invented an efficient gadget for keeping that lens clear, McCafferty reflected. You'd think that after 80-some years...
Water looks a little murky, too, Joe answered, hopefully.
A visual sighting by anti-submarine warfare aircraft is one of the nightmares all submariners share.
Doesn't look like a nice day to fly, does it?
I don't think we have to worry about somebody getting an eyeball sight on us.
The captain spoke loudly enough for the control room crew to hear.
The water deepens out some for the next 2 miles, the navigator reported.
How much?
5 fathoms, skipper.
McCafferty looked over at the XO, who was conning the boat at the moment.
Use it.
On the other hand, some helicopter jockey might get lucky.
Aye.
Diving officer, take her down another 20 feet.
Gently.
Aye.
The chief gave the necessary orders to the plainsman, and you could feel the sighs through the attack center.
McCafferty shook his head.
When was the last time you saw your men look relieved over a 20-foot change in depth? He asked himself. He went forward to sonar. He did not remember being there only 4 minutes earlier.
How are our friends doing, Chief?
The patrol boats are still faint, sir. They seem to be circling. The bearings are changing back and forth like they've been doing.
The boomer's blade count is also constant, sir. He's just tooling right along at 15 knots.
Not especially quiet, either.
I mean, we still got plenty of mechanical transients, you know.
There's maintenance work, a lot of it going on in there by the sound he's making.
Want to listen in, skipper?
The chief held up a pair of earphones. Most sonar scanning was done visually. The onboard computers converted acoustical signals into a display on TV-type tubes that looked most of all like some sort of arcade game. But there was still no real substitute for listening in.
McCafferty took the phones.
First he heard the Delta's whirring reactor pumps. They were running at medium speed, driving water out of the reactor vessel into the steam generator. Next he concentrated on the screw sounds. The Russian boomer had a pair of 5-bladed screws, and he tried to make his own count of the chugga-chugga noise made as each blade made its circuit.
No good. He'd have to take the chief's word, as he usually did.
Clang!
What was that?
The chief turned to another senior operator.
Hatch slamming?
The first-class sonarman shook his head judiciously.
More like somebody dropped a wrench. Close, though. Pretty close.
The captain had to smile. Everybody aboard was trying to affect a casual manner that had to be outrageously faked. Certainly everyone was as tense as he was, and McCafferty wanted nothing more than to get the hell out of this miserable lake. Of course, he couldn't act in such a way as to allow his crew to become overly concerned. The captain must be in total control at all times.
"What fucking games we play," he told himself.
"What are we doing here? What is going on in this crazy world? I don't want to fight a fucking war."
He leaned against the doorframe, just forward of the control room, only a few feet from his own stateroom, wanting to go in, just to lie down for a minute or two, to take a few deep breaths, maybe go to a sink and splash a little cold water. But then he might accidentally look in the mirror.
None of that, he knew. Command of a submarine was one of the last truly godlike jobs left in the world, and at times it required a truly godlike demeanor. Like now.
Play the game, Danny, he told himself.
The captain withdrew a handkerchief from his back pocket and rubbed his nose with it, his face locked into a neutral, almost bored expression, as his eyes traced over the sonar displays.
The cool captain.
McCafferty returned to the attack center a moment later, telling himself that he'd spent just enough time to inspire his sonar crewmen without pressuring them with too much attention from the CO. A fine balance. He looked around casually. The room was as crowded as an Irish bar on St. Patrick's Day. His men's outwardly cool faces were sweating, despite the nuclear-powered air conditioning.
The planesmen especially were concentrating on their instruments, guiding the submarine down an electronically defined display, with the diving officer, Chicago's most senior chief, right behind them. In the center of the control room, the two side-by-side attack periscopes were fully retracted, with a quartermaster's mate poised to raise them. The exo paced as much as he could, looking at the chart every 20 seconds or so as he turned at the rear of the compartment. Not much here to complain about. Everybody was tense, but all the work was getting done.
"All things considered," McCafferty said for all to hear, "things are going pretty good. Surface conditions are working against them detecting us."
"Khan, sonar."
"Khan, aye."
The captain took the phone.
"Hull popping noises. He seems to be surfacing."
"Yeah, target is now blowing tank, skipper."
"Understood.
Keep us posted, chief." McCafferty put the phone back. He took 3 steps back to the chart table.
"Why surface now?"
The navigator stole a cigarette from an enlisted man and lit it. McCafferty knew he didn't smoke. The lieutenant nearly gagged on it, drawing a brief smirk from a second-class quartermaster and a rueful grin from the navigator. He looked over at the captain.
"Sir, something is wrong about this," the lieutenant said quietly.
"Just one thing," the captain asked. "Why did he surface here?"
"Khan, sonar."
McCafferty went forward and took the phone again.
"Skipper, the boomer's doing a long blow, really blowing his tanks out like, sir."
"Anything else unusual?"
"No, sir, but he must have just used a lot of his reserve air, sir."
"Okay, chief, thank you."
McCafferty hung up and wondered if that meant anything.
"Sir, you ever done this before?" the navigator asked.
"I've trailed a lot of Russian boats, but no, never in here.
The target has to surface eventually. Only 60 feet of water down here along Tersky Barrag." The navigator traced his finger along the chart.
"And we have to break off the trail," McCafferty agreed. "But that's another 40 miles.
"Yeah." The navigator nodded agreement. "But starting 5 miles back, this gulf starts to narrow down like a funnel. And for a submerged sub, it eventually closes down to 2. Then only 1 safe passage. Geez, I don't know." McCafferty came aft again to examine the chart. He was content to run 15 knots at periscope depth all this way down from Kola. The usable depth has been about the same for the past 5 hours. Just bottomed out some. And figures to be the same for another hour or two. But he surfaces anyway.
"So," McCafferty said, "the only change in environmental conditions is the width of the channel. And that's still over 20 miles.
The captain mulled this over, staring down at the chart. The sonar room called yet again.
"Khan, aye. What is it, chief?"
"New contact, sir. Bearing 192. Designate target Sierra 5. Twin-screw surface ship, diesel engines. They just came on all at once, sir. Sounds like a Natya class. Bearing changing right to left slowly. Seems to be converging with the boomer. Blade count puts her speed at about 12 knots.
"What's the boomer doing?"
"Speed and bearing are unchanged, skipper. The blow has ended. She's on the surface, sir. We're starting to get pounding and some racing on her screws. Wait a minute. An active sonar just started up. We're getting reverbs. Bearing seems to be about 190, probably from the Natya. It's a very high-frequency sonar, above aural range. I make it 22,000 hertz. An icy ball suddenly materialized in McCafferty's stomach.
"XO, I'm taking the Khan."
"Aye, Captain, you have the Khan."
"Diving officer, get her up to 60 feet, high as you can without broaching her. Observation. Upscope."
The search scope came up, and McCafferty met it, as he had before, and quickly checked the surface of the sea for shadows.
3 more feet. Okay, still nothing.
"What's the ESM reading?"
Now 7 active radar sources, Skipper. Plot out about the same as before, plus the new one at 191. Another India band. Looks like another Don 2.
McCafferty turned the periscope handle to 12 power, its highest setting. The Soviet missile submarine was sitting extremely high in the water.
"Joe, tell me what you see," McCafferty asked, wanting a quick second opinion.
"That's a Delta III, all right. Looks like she's blown dry, Captain. They come out pretty far, and that looks like about 3 or 4 feet higher than they usually do. He just used up a lot of his air. That might be the Natia's mast ahead of her. Hard to be sure."
McCafferty could feel that his own Chicago was rolling. His hands tingled with the transmitted wave slaps against the periscope. The seas were crashing against the Delta II, and he could see water splashing in and out of the limber holes that lined the boomer's flanks.
"ESM board says that signal strengths are approaching detection values," the technician warned.
"His periscopes are both up," McCafferty said, knowing that his scope had already been up too long. He squeezed the trigger to double the magnification. It cost optical detail, but the picture zoomed in on the Delta's conning tower. "The control station atop his sail is fully manned. Everyone has glasses. Not looking aft, though. Downscope. Diving officer, take her down 10 feet. Nice work, plainsman. Let's see that tape, Joe."
The picture returned to the TV monitor in a few seconds.
They were 2,000 yards behind the Delta. Beyond her, by about half a mile, was a spherical radar dome, probably the Natia, rolling noticeably with the beam seas. To house her 16 SS-18 missiles, the Russian sub had a sloped turtleback, and from directly aft it looked like a highway ramp. An ungainly design, the Delta, but she had to survive only long enough to launch her missiles, and the Americans had no doubt that her missiles worked just fine.
"Look at that, they blew her so high half her screws are clear," the XO pointed.
"Navigator, how far to shallow water?"
"Along this channel, a minimum of 24 fathoms for 10 miles.
"Why did the Delta surface this far out?"
McCafferty lifted the phone.
"Sonar, tell me about the Natia."
"Skipper, he's pinging away like mad. Not toward us, but we're getting lots of reflections and reverberations off the bottom."
The Natia was a specialized mine hunter, also used, to be sure, as an escort for submarines in and out of safe areas. But her mine-hunting VHF sonar was operating. Dear God.
"Left full rudder," McCafferty shouted.
"Left full rudder, aye." The helmsman would have hit the overhead but for the seatbelt. He instantly snapped his wheel to port.
"Sir, my rudder is left full."
"Minefield," the navigator breathed. Heads all over the room turned around.
"That's a good bet."
McCafferty nodded grimly. "How far are we from the point where the boomer rendezvoused with the Natia?" The navigator examined the plot closely.
"Stopped about 400 yards short of it, sir."
"All stop."
"All stop, aye."
The helmsman dialed the annunciator handle. "Engine room answers, all stop, sir. Passing left through 180, sir."
"Very well. We ought to be safe enough here. You have to figure the Delta'd rendezvous with the sweeper a few miles clear of the field, right? Anybody here think Ivan would gamble with a boomer?" It was a rhetorical question. Nobody ever gambled with boomers. Everyone in the control room took a deep breath at the same moment. The Chicago slowed rapidly, her turn taking her broadside to her previous course. "Rudder amidships." McCafferty ordered 1/3 speed and lifted the phone for sonar.
"The boomer doing anything different?"
"No, sir. Bearing is still constant at 190. Speed still 15 knots. We can still hear the Natia pinging, nearing 186, and her blade count is now about 15 knots, too."
"Navigator, start figuring a way for us to get out of here.
We want to keep well clear of all those patrol boats and report this news in as quick as we can.
Aye. 358 looks pretty good for the moment, sir.
The navigator had been updating that course continuously for 2 hours.
Sir, if Ivan really has laid out a minefield, part of it's in international waters, the exec noted.
Cute.
Yeah. Of course, to them it's territorial waters, so anybody bumps into a mine, it's just too damn bad.
And maybe an international incident, Joe observed.
But why did they ping at all? The communications officer asked. If they got a clear channel, they can navigate visually.
What if there's no channel at all? The exec answered.
What if they set ground mines and moored mines strung, say, at a uniform depth of 50 feet?
You'd have to figure they'd be a little nervous that a mine or two might have too long a mooring cable.
So they're playing it safe, just like we do. What's all that tell you?
Nobody can trail their boomers without surfacing, the lieutenant understood.
And we sure as hell aren't going to do that. Nobody ever said that Ivan was dumb. They got a perfect system here. They're putting all their missile boats where we can't get at them, McCafferty went on. Even Subrock can't make it from where we are into the White Sea.
Final point. If they have to scatter the boats, they don't have to screw around in a single channel. They can all surface, spread out, and run for daylight.
What this means, gentlemen, is that instead of detailing an attack boat to guard every boomer against somebody like us, they can put all the missile boats into one nice, safe basket and release their attack boats to other missions. Let's get the hell out of here.
North Atlantic. Ship in view, this is U.S. Navy aircraft on your port beam. Please identify. Over.
Captain Kiroff handed the bridge-to-bridge phone to a Red Army major.
Navy, this is the Dr. Likes. How are y'all?
Kiroff spoke halting English.
The major's Mississippi accent might well have been Kurdish, for all he understood of it. He could barely make out the haze-gray patrol aircraft that was now circling their ship. Circling, they noted, at a 5-mile distance, and certainly inspecting them through binoculars.
"Amplify, Dr. Likes," the voice ordered tersely. "We're out of New Orleans, bound for Oslo with General Cargo Navy. What's the big deal?"
"You're well north of a course to Norway. Please explain. Over."
"Y'all read the damn papers, Navy? It's liable to get dangerous out here, and this big old ship costs money. We got orders from the Home Office to keep close to some friendly folks. Hell, we're glad to see you, boy. Y'all want to escort us a ways?"
"Roger. Copy. Dr. Likes, be advised, no submarines known to be in this area."
"Y'all guarantee that?"
This drew a laugh.
"Not hardly, Doc." "That's about what I thought, Navy. Well, if it's all right with you, we'll keep heading north a ways and try to stay under your air cover. Over."
"We can't detail an aircraft to escort you."
"Understood, but you will come if we call you, right?"
"That's a roger," agreed Penguin 8.
"Okay, we'll continue north, then turn east for the Faroes. Will you warn us if any bad guys show up? Over."
"If we find any, Doc, the idea is we'll try and sink 'em first," the pilot exaggerated.
"Fair enough. Good hunting, boy. Out."
Penguin 8. "God, do people really talk like that?" the pilot of the Orion wondered aloud.
"Never heard about Likes lines," his co-pilot chuckled. "They used to say they wouldn't hire a guy unless he had a southern accent. I never believed it until now. Nothing like tradition. He is kind of off the beaten track, though."
"Yeah, but until the convoys form up, hell, I'd try to bounce from one protected area to another. Anyway, let's finish the visual."
The pilot increased power and headed in closer while his co-pilot lifted the recognition book.
"Okay, we have an all-black hull with Likes lines on the side midships. White superstructure with black diamond, a block L inside the diamond."
He lifted his binoculars.
Lookout mast forward of the superstructure. Check. Superstructure is nicely raked. Electronics mast is not. Proper ensign and house flag. Black funnels. Winches aft by the barge elevator. Doesn't say how many winches. Damn, she's carrying a full load of barges, isn't she? Paintwork looks a little shabby. Anyway, it all checks with the book. That's a friendly. Okay, let's give her a wave. The pilot turned the yoke to the left, taking the Orion directly over the barge carrier. He waggled his wings slightly as he passed overhead, and two men on the bridge waved back at them. The flyers couldn't pick out the two men tracking them with handheld SAMs. Good luck, fella. You might need it. MV Julius Fusik.
The new paint scheme will make visual spotting difficult, Comrade General, the air defense officer said quietly. I saw no air-to-surface missiles attached.
That will change quickly enough. As soon as our fleet puts to sea, they will load them. Besides, if they identify us as enemy, how far can we run while they call up other aircraft, or simply fly to their base to rearm?
The general watched the aircraft depart. His heart had been in his throat for the whole episode, but now he could walk out to where Kirov stood on the open bridge wing. Only the ship's officers had been issued American-style khaki uniforms.
My compliments to your language, officer. I presume he was speaking English?
Andreev laughed jovially, now that the danger was past.
So I am told. The Navy requested a man with his particular skills. He's an intelligence officer, served in America.
In any case, he succeeded. Now we may approach our objective safely, Kirov said, using the last word relatively.
It will be good to be on land again, Comrade Captain.
The general didn't like being on such a large, unprotected target, and would not feel safe until he had solid ground under his feet. At least, as an infantryman, you had a rifle with which to defend yourself, usually a hole to hide in, and always two legs to run away. Not so on a ship, he had learned. A ship was one large target, and this one was virtually unprotected. Amazing, he thought, that anything would feel worse than being on a transport aircraft. But there he had a parachute. He had no illusions about his ability to swim to land.
Sunnyvale, California.
There goes another one, the chief master sergeant said. It was almost boring now. Never in the colonel's memory had the Soviets had more than 6 photographic reconnaissance satellites in orbit. There were now 10, plus 10 electronic intelligence gatherers, some launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome outside Leninsk in the Kazakh SSR, the other half from Plesetsk in northern Russia.
That's an F-type booster, Colonel. Burn time is wrong for the A-type, the sergeant said, looking up from his watch.
This Russian booster was a derivation of the old SS-9 ICBM, and it had only 2 functions: to launch radar ocean reconnaissance satellites, called RORSATs, that monitored ships at sea, and to loft the Soviet anti-satellite system. The Americans were watching the launch from a newly launched KH-11 reconnaissance satellite of their own, sweeping over the central region of the USSR. The colonel lifted the phone to Cheyenne Mountain.
USS Faris.
I should be sleeping, Morris told himself. I should stockpile sleep, bank it away against the time when I can't have any. But he was too keyed up to sleep. USS Faris was steaming figure eights off the mouth of the Delaware River. 30 miles north, at the piers of Philadelphia, Chester, and Camden, ships of the National Reserve Defense Fleet that had been held in readiness for years were getting ready to sail.
Cargo holds were loading with tanks, guns, and crates of explosive ordnance. His air search radar showed the tracks of numerous troop transports lifting out of Dover Air Force Base. The Military Airlift Command's huge aircraft could ferry the troops across to Germany, where they would be mated with their pre-positioned equipment. But when their unit loads of munitions ran out,